FS Insider, a premium edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Today's host is Senior Editor Chris Sheridan.
What's the most valuable commodity traded in the world today? Many of you might say gold, oil, or possibly even diamonds. But according to today's guest, the answer to that question is data. Joining us on the show today is Thomas Kolopoulos. He's the co-author of a must-read book, Revealing the Invisible: How Our Hidden Behaviors Are Becoming the Most Valuable Commodity of the 21st Century. Tom, one thing that really struck me about your book was the astounding scale by which human behavior is being commoditized today. Let's talk about that and how this is becoming or is already the new global currency.
You know, I was talking with a colleague yesterday who had just finished reading the book, and her comment to me was, you know, I was really scared before I read the book, and now I'm terrified. My comment to her was, oh, and by the way, this is an optimist point of view. I mean, this book is written with a great deal, I think, of realism and optimism. It's not a gloom and doom book. But nonetheless, when you read it, you get a sense for, as you said, the sheer scale of data that's being captured about all of us. And it's not just Facebook. I mean, we tend to focus on Facebook, right? But it's being captured by dozens of players who are looking at our in-store behaviors, looking at our online behaviors, looking at us through digital cameras that capture our physical behaviors. All of this is creating this enormous asset base that tells you a great deal about who I am, what I do, and maybe what I'm likely to do going forward.
I won't read the entire list that you include in the appendix section. So if people want to see just exactly what is being collected, I mean, you have it fills pages and pages of all the different categories that are included. I mean, it's massive. So, I mean, really, there is a treasure trove, like you explain, a gold mine that is awaiting companies that's being used, commoditized, traded, stored. Let's talk about the title of your book, Revealing the Invisible. What exactly does that encompass?
So the reason, there's a lot behind that title. The reason that we call it the invisible is because there's so much that you and I do on an ongoing basis behaviorally, which we don't even notice about ourselves. If you ask me for certain preferences I might have or certain habits I might have, I have a natural bias. And the reality is a lot of what I do, I don't keep track of. If you begin to keep track of my behaviors empirically, things begin to emerge that might even be surprising to me, but nonetheless are truths. Truths about, you know, how many times I brush my teeth, how many times I floss, simple things like that, but also behaviors about how I drive. I mean, I think we all want to believe we're above average drivers, right? It doesn't work that way. The reality is that we exhibit behavior in those moments when we are not conscious of it, and nothing has been tracking that behavior until recently. So the invisible is, on the one hand, all the nuances of what you and I do thousands of times each day that begin to create a persona, what we call a digital self in the book. The other side of the invisible is that we're starting to see devices that are equipped with artificial intelligence exhibit behaviors. And when you're in a car, an autonomous vehicle, for example, which we talk about a great deal in the book, the first thing that strikes you is, my goodness, this thing is behaving. It has some sort of an intelligence about it that is able to assess the situation. It has situational awareness. And that behavior is invisible because we don't expect that of machines. So suddenly we're thrust into this new normal where the machines begin to exhibit behaviors, and at the same time, simultaneously, our behaviors are being captured by them. It's an interesting new dance that we're doing with technology.
Yeah, and that's one thing that you discuss is how a lot of Tesla drivers, they naturally form this relationship or this bond with their cars, and they refer to them as if they're people. And this is really exemplifying this change that's taking place when products or services or the technology that we possess have some level of autonomy, correct?
Well, and beyond, yes, absolutely. And beyond that, and this is the part that I find really fascinating and really cool, is that the devices get to know us. So this relationship that you talk about, a relationship by definition is a two-way street. You can't have a one-way relationship. I mean, I had cars when I was young, and I think I gave them names, but the cars didn't know me. I was attached to them, but as you might be with any inanimate object. Suddenly, the inanimate objects have a behavior, an intelligence. They get you, and they begin to conform to your behaviors and your idiosyncrasies. And now you've got a real relationship going on, which is very different than the kind that we typify as, you know, being attached to an inanimate object because of a sentimental reason. Now you're attached because it understands you, it gets you, and it accommodates you. And when you accommodate someone, you build trust. That's what relationships are based on. So imagine doing this now with devices. And it sounds a bit creepy. It sounds odd because we haven't been there yet. But, you know, we talk in the book about the fact that way back when, at the turn of the last century, when the Sears catalog became very popular and very big, what we don't realize is that we stepped away from the familiarity of the general store. People loved the general store because it wasn't just a place to buy. The general storekeeper knew you, knew your kids, knew your life, knew what was going on. And as a result, could help you sort of buy goods that fit your life. And you paid a premium for it. From that, we went to the Sears catalog, which totally anonymized us, made us part of a demographic subgroup at best. But Sears never knew me. It never had any loyalty to me. And now we seem to be coming all the way back full circle, where the retailer, Amazon, starting to do this better. They've got a ways to go. Really is starting to know me. And I think that's this notion of relationship now applies to so many different ways in which we interact with not just devices, but with retailers, with commerce, and certainly with artificial intelligence.
Yeah, and you write about how in the industrial era, I mean, most of the products and services that were sold to people were done based on focus groups or just an average. There was the average consumer, but that's a far cry from what we see today, right?
And this gets into what we call hyper-personalization, Chris, which is this notion of I was loyal to brands because I liked the brand. And it could have been anything from Aquafresh toothpaste to my Diet Coke to the kind of car that I drive. But that loyalty was a one-way street, right? That Pepsi didn't know who I was. Coke didn't know who I was. J&J didn't know who I was. BMW didn't know who I was. I was a customer, but that's the best they had about it was what they might capture through a loyalty program. But I was still loyal to them. Suddenly now, they have the option to be loyal to me. So when I bring my BMW in for service, the minute I walk through the door, it could be a dealership I've never been to before, brand new dealership. They know who I am. They know my history because my key fob, immediately brings up my record on their computer screen. So the brand is now getting into a situation where they can, if they choose to use the technology correctly, to express this kind of loyalty towards me. That's a very different model than what we grew up with in the industrial era, where I was just an unknown. I was part of a focus group, part of a market segment. And you had to bundle me with tens of thousands or millions of other people to identify my very broad-based needs. No longer. You can now, in real time, understand who I am, what I'm doing, how that behavior is changing. And then again, if you choose to be intelligent enough as a business, you can then accommodate it. I mean, what a cool thing, right? I mean, once we get beyond the creep factor of that, it actually creates enormous value for me. I mean, wouldn't you love to have a personal shopper? I'd love to have a personal shopper.
Right.
Because, you know, if you look at my closet right now, I will guarantee you half that closet is what I call a closet of regret. It's all the stuff that no longer fits me, but I keep holding on to it, just hoping that someday it will. I'd love to have a personal shopper who constantly has things in my closet that fit me perfectly, are in style. That would be a neat, neat thing to do. But to do that, I'd have to share a lot of information with that personal shopper, and she or he would have to get to know me really well. Well, that's kind of the role of AI now. It's getting to know you in such a way that it can be very accommodating to your needs. That's a very cool thing. I don't think, once we've had that, I don't think any of us will want to go back to not having it.
Let's talk about some of the companies that are utilizing this hyper-personalization approach. I know many people are familiar that have been listening to our podcast for some time, an acronym that is widely used in the financial industry, and that's the FANG stocks, right?
Yes,
so
yes.
Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, and Google. I think those are probably the best examples that we have. But you talk about Netflix leveraging hyper-personalization to an extent that I wasn't even aware of.
Yeah, Netflix is an amazing example. And you know what? They do it so well that people don't know they're doing it. And that really is the hallmark of a company that hyper-personalizes well. With Amazon, with Google, even with Facebook, there's a little bit of a creep factor there. I feel like I'm being observed. At times, I'm getting recommendations that don't exactly fit my behavioral profile. I'll give you a great example. We talk about this in the book, too. We had an eclipse here in the Northeast last year. Very cool eclipse. And it was really tough to get eclipse sunglasses. So I had gone online for days before trying to find someone who had eclipse sunglasses. I must have done hundreds of searches. And I finally got them in a local library. Well, wouldn't you know it? 2-3 weeks after the eclipse was over, and the next one's not for another 10 years or what have you, I was getting all kinds of ads that were popping up in my browser for Eclipse sunglasses. Yeah. I mean, so it's not creepy, but it's odd. It's disconcerting. It's like, okay, do you get me? Do you get the fact that I no longer need Eclipse sunglasses? These are a once a decade sort of purchase. So as much as they're trying, a lot of companies are very awkward at best in how they do this. Netflix, however, has done amazingly well. We don't even get that things are being personalized. So when you see an advertisement for a new series, a new Netflix series, it's being customized to your taste, to your behaviors, what else you've watched, even the color preferences. You have your own color palette that Netflix knows about. What do you respond to well? I mean, I like reds. I like deep navy blues. I'm colorblind as well. So I like colors that are off the spectrum, that really are vibrant. I don't get subtlety in color. So they know that about me, and they'll show me ads that based on the genre of what I like and based on my color sensitivities will get my attention. I don't even know they're doing that. Now, on the one hand, look, I don't want to be naive about this. Am I being manipulated? Potentially. And that's part of the danger that we talk about in the book, that there's huge opportunity for manipulation. And we have to be enormously vigilant. We talk about the importance of legislation. And this is an area where government should be involved. As much as I hate to say that, there has to be some oversight. Because there's enormous opportunity for manipulation here. And we've seen that recently. We saw that both from a political standpoint. We saw it with Cambridge Analytica and what happened, the fiasco with Facebook. But that's the tip of a very, very large iceberg. So we need to make sure that as we move forward and as this data is aggregated and as models like what Netflix is doing are applied on a much broader basis to much more important things, not just my media habits, but other habits that I have, that data is being used in a way that is correct and which, you know, I'm okay with, that I've approved, that I'm actually getting value for whatever it is that I'm giving up.
Tom, let's talk about the digital self. This is something that comes up as a recurring theme and subject in your book. To many people, I think that this is going to be far-fetched. And even when I first read it in your book or when you first started talking about it, I was kind of like, I don't know about that. That's probably way far off. But you really do an amazing job at explaining just how we have a digital self currently and how it's going to change in the years ahead, particularly with AI and some of the other things that you mentioned as well. So let's talk about this digital self and how you see it moving forward.
So let me give you an analogy here, Chris, because you're right. When you first introduce folks to this notion of a digital self, they're not quite sure what to make of it because they haven't experienced it yet. So I'll give you an analogy. Let's say that you've got a network of friends and professional acquaintances, and they know you from different perspectives. So maybe there are folks that you, friends that you go out with to have a drink or to maybe, you know, play some sports games. There are friends that you work with. There are colleagues that you've professionally been connected to for decades. You have your spouse, you have, you know, your children, you have your parents. Each knows you from a different perspective. Now, let's say I got all these folks in one room and was able to somehow bring together all that knowledge about you. I would have a near perfect understanding of who you are. I would know all the nuances of your behavior. And now I would be able to, because I understand you, if I had good intentions, form a more intimate relationship with you because I get you. I understand who you are as a person. Well, that's kind of where we are today with the digital self. It exists in a very fragmented way. Apple owns part of my digital self. Google does. Facebook does. Dozens of online marketing agencies do. Netflix certainly does. So it's fragmented and pieces of it are out there. It's kind of like that big room I was talking about with all of your friends and your relatives and your colleagues in it. But they haven't been talking to each other, at least not a whole lot. The real precipice of change here is when all that data gets aggregated. Then your digital self comes into being as a single entity. And I think we're very close to that, Chris. So we're certainly no more than 10 years away from it and probably closer to 5 years away from it. Some of it will happen, by the way, because companies will be acquired. Companies that own some of your digital data will be acquired by other companies. And much of the value of those companies, by the way, will be in that digital data. So Facebook will acquire companies that know a bit about you in hopes that they will know a bit more about you. And as that gets aggregated, your digital self will exist as a single entity. That's where the real promise and the real threat resides. Because now I know you from every perspective, from every angle. And the question we raise in the book, and it's a very important one, is, so who owns that? Is it owned by a corporation? Is it owned, does the government have some role in owning a piece of this and protecting it the way they should with your SSN and your information that's linked to your SSN? Do you own it? And who writes the terms and conditions for it? And by the way, we bring up in the book a really off the wall idea. Why shouldn't you write the terms and conditions for it? Why shouldn't you be the one that says, hey, my digital self has value, and here are the terms under which I will share it. Today, we don't do that. Today, the terms and conditions are written by the vendors under virtually no oversight whatsoever, legal or legislative oversight. And the other thing, the last thing I want to bring up on this point, because it's really important, and we miss this so often in conversations about technology, we've got 7.5 billion people on the planet. At least 3 billion of them don't have any form of identity, much less a digital one. They can't open a bank account. They can't get a mortgage. They can't get a loan because they're faceless entities. They have no legal persona. These are people that can't participate in commerce the way you and I do. What if we gave each of them an irrefutable digital identity that becomes such an enormously critical asset for them to be able to build their education, their wealth, their careers, all the things that we take for granted in the rest of the world? So this disenfranchised 3 billion, which will become 4 billion, it might become 5 billion, we need to start chipping away at that by creating this notion of a digital self as an irrefutable identity that everyone owns from the moment of birth.
Where does blockchain fit into this commoditization of human behavior?
Yeah, and you brought it up at just the right time, Chris, because this is being done. So what I just described is being done in Estonia, of all places. And we have got a wonderful part of the book where we talk about how Estonia actually built this digital infrastructure, which it has as a result of an enormous, one of the world's largest hacking attacks of a nation state. But what they have in place right now is a blockchain-driven identity that, by the way, you and I could do this as well. You can have a global digital identity that you get through Estonia. You don't have to be a citizen, but every citizen gets this digital identity from the get-go, and it's done using the blockchain. So the beauty of blockchain, and we talk about it in the book, we get into a bit more detail, but suffice it to say that the real beauty of blockchain is that it creates irrefutability and an indelible record, so that whether it's a piece of property I own, or whether it's my identity, or whether it's, you know, a cryptocurrency, it's irrefutable that I own that it belongs to me. And one of the most important economists of the last 50 years, Hernando de Soto, Peruvian economist, wrote this wonderful book, The Mystery of Capital. I think it's at least 20, or maybe it's even 30 years old now. But the book gets into how the real cornerstone of a free market, of a capitalist market, and for that matter, of a democracy, is the irrefutability of property ownership. When I own something, you can't take it away from me. I mean, I own my house, I own my car, I own whatever it is. You cannot take it away from me. That evidentiary trail is not something that you can erase in a true free market that is healthy. There are parts of the world where that's easily erased by government or other factions that are not working in your best interest. But De Soto's point is that we need that to build a truly efficient and effective and reliable free market. Well, guess what? Blockchain does that for anyone, anywhere in the world. And it creates a whole new level, I think, of economic and potential for economic prosperity and well-being that simply has not existed up until now.
Tom, one thing you discuss in your book is just the sheer explosion of data and the limits that we're approaching when it comes to the amount of energy required to sustain this modern data-driven economy that we live in. What are some of those limits?
Yeah, that's a great question, Chris, because we can approach that on several fronts. Number one, people don't realize that the amount of data we're collecting is so great that at some point, and depending on your math, we've done a few models here, somewhere between 2050 and 2100, being very conservative at 2100, more than likely it's going to be closer to 2050. If we keep collecting data at the rate we are right now, and if we add to it the genomic data that we're sure to be creating for every human being on the planet, autonomous vehicles that generate 4 terabytes of information every single day, we will quite literally have run out of atoms in the entire universe if we stored one bit of data on every single atom. You can't do that. In other words, you just can't sustain that level of data creation and storage. So something has to give. And look, maybe there are technical ways that we'll get around that through quantum computing, perhaps. Nonetheless, it gives you a sense of scale, what's going on. The other side of that is, but that's just bits, and bits don't use natural resources, but they do. By 2025, the data centers around the world are going to use more energy than the aviation industry does today. So we're getting to the point where it's becoming a ecological issue as well. The carbon footprint created by data centers where all this data is stored in the cloud is becoming an issue. But let me give you the one that really says to me, we're getting to the end of the industrial age and we had better get our act together if we want to survive as a species and if we want this planet to survive despite us. If you look at the automotive industry, some of the stats are absolutely outrageous. I'll give you one that cuts close to home. Over a million people, 1.3 million people every year die in automobile accidents. About 50 million are injured and some severely. And we've all been touched by this. None of us have escaped this, right? We all know someone, if not ourselves, who've been affected by this. What if I were to tell you that 90% of that, 90% of that is caused by human error? And we could get rid of all that human error through autonomous vehicles. Not just that, but we could actually take the number of cars that are on the planet today, and rather than increase them to 2, 3, 4, 5 billion from the 1 billion or so vehicles that we have today, which would absolutely destroy our ecosystem, we can cut that down to a tenth of what it is today. So by 2050, we could actually have 1/10 the number of automobiles on the road that we do today globally. And yet we could have a population that maybe goes from 7.5 billion to, at that point, 8.5 or 9 billion. And the reason we can do that is because of these technologies, because of AI, because of these post-industrial approaches to using data and AI as a means by which to build the next era of commerce and society. The industrial model was great. It worked. It did what it was supposed to do. It scaled really, really well. But we can't keep scaling it from a human standpoint, from an industrial standpoint, from an ecological standpoint. We've reached the end. And to me, much of what we talk about in the book is how we're going to begin to understand and go into this new era where we enable 10 billion people to have incredible access to resources without destroying the planet in the process.
Well, if any of you want to read more about this recent book that was just released last month, the title again is Revealing the Invisible, How Our Hidden Behaviors Are Becoming the Most Valuable Commodity of the 21st Century. I certainly consider it a must-read book. You can pick it up at Amazon or anywhere else you like to shop for your books. I'll also have a link out to it where this interview is located on Financial Sense. Tom, I want to thank you for writing such an interesting and fascinating book. There's a lot in it that we didn't get a chance to cover today, but I do want to encourage our listeners to pick it up and go through it. Again, thank you for coming on the show today. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Chris. It was my pleasure. It was a fun book to write too, and I appreciate all the kind words about it. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
You too.
So as Tom explained in this interview, there's a massive amount of data that's being collected by all of us. He says here that in a typical day, over 250 data points about your life and your behavior are being captured. Everything from the websites you visit, your smartphone and its apps, sensors in your home, electronic devices you interact with, your car, and even the movement of your eyes as you scan the shelves at the grocery store. And the interesting thing about this, referring to Revealing the Invisible, the title of his book, is that 90% of our behavior is stuff that we're not even really aware of. We are only conscious of 5 to 10% of the things that we are doing. There's a whole slew of things that obviously we forget or that is subconscious, unconscious. So that massive amount of data that is revealing those hidden behaviors, the hidden motivations for why we do what we do that we're not actually conscious of, those are things that companies are tracking, and they're creating this digital self, this avatar of every one of us. And you know, as he points out in the appendix, there is just a massive amount of information that goes into that. I mean, everything from just identifying data, of course, name, address, phone number, email, but then you also have your sensitive identification data that can be used. So your birth date, driver's license number, birth date of your children, and there's demographic data that goes on and on. There's court and public record data, social media and technology data, which can be everything from political leaning to your personal tastes, the type of food that you like to eat, where you like to go and eat, different restaurants. Your neighborhood data, you know, all the general interest data, financial data, vehicle data. I mean, it just goes on and on and on and on. So if you take those hundreds of different data points and you compile them together, you get this digital self, and it's more like you than the physical you, because there's a lot about us that we don't convey or that we ourselves aren't even aware of. But the digital self will have all of that contained in it. So who owns this digital self? And that's where it gets into the importance of blockchain technology. And he mentioned that a little bit in the tail end of the interview with what's going on with Estonia. that definitely seems to be the way that we're headed as well. But, you know, the problem with all of this is that our modern society, which runs off this massive digital ecosystem where FANG stocks, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google, you know, where they have all of this data that they're storing, that they're trading, they're using, it's very energy intensive. And so, as you mentioned, the energy requirement for these data centers that are now all around the globe is so high. And because of the exponential rate at which they're expanding and which data is exploding, eventually we're going to be hitting some limits. And so, as you mentioned, you know, there needs to be some type of change in how we store data and how we use it, and especially the means by which all of this is organized. And so that's where artificial intelligence comes in, as Tom mentioned. He talks about, there's a theme in the book about how the complexity of our modern world is codependent on the complexity of the technology that we build. For example, if you were to take away all of the computers from society today, it would set us back quite a bit further. And today's society, I mean, you think about the economy, the financial system, modern communication, all of this is enabled and made possible by the level of computation that we have today. And so he explains that artificial intelligence is just a further build or advancement on the complexity of technology to where it has a more of an autonomous nature. And so that's directly related to the scale of complexity of our world. So that's an interesting thought when you think about, you know, how AI is or could be necessary for our civilization to advance from its current state. He seems to make that point, in addition to many others. So if you want to read this book in full, I would certainly recommend it. It's got very high rating on Amazon. I enjoyed it immensely. Lots of interesting information that he goes into that we covered today. Title of it is Revealing the Invisible, How Our Hidden Behaviors Are Becoming the Most Valuable Commodity of the 21st Century. If you have any questions or comments about what we discussed today, feel free to email me. My email address is cris@financialsense.com. I'm Chris Sheridan. You're listening to FS Insider.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.